Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at Burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at Burrow.com/ACAST.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
You are back in the House of Mystery, and of course, I'm Al Warren. We got Mr. Martini.
I'm here.
Making the cocktails.
Making the cocktails in the basement of the House of Mystery.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you have never left there, have you?
The basement?
Yeah.
No.
No.
You won't let me out.
Well, that's for the protection of society.
Well, that's true. That is true.
It's not the best. Yeah. Be careful. We've got enough dangerous people out there.
That's right.
Anyway.
It'll be Dangerous Dave from now on.
Dangerous Dave. You know. I know you're just couldn't wait to get out and see the Johnny Depp trial. You want to get out there and start screaming at all the people and couldn't let you out. No, that would have been
no.
You would end up in jail. I know.
That's right.
It's just terrible.
You keep me safe.
Keep you safe, you know. Well, you can't be dressing like Amber Heard. You know?
No. So,
one is enough for this country.
No fish costumes either.
No.
Aquaman, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Boo. Okay. Well, let's get down to the even more dangerous character. So we've got a writer today. His book, I was going to say his latest book, and it is, but it's also his first, is called Bottle Lightning. And it's Mr. L.M. Weeks. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
I always say, wait till the end before you say it was a pleasure. We're not. Oh, most people get through it. They don't hang up on us too often. What made you get into writing? I mean, you were, it looks like, practicing law for a long time, right? What, 34 years. So what would make someone being fairly successful in the legal department all of a sudden go, well, I'm going to write a book?
Well, there are probably a lot of writers like this. I think a lot of lawyers are, you know, wannabe actors or writers or failed actors or writers. But in my case, I participated in some creative writing contests when I was in grammar school, so between I think fourth and sixth grade, and I won a couple of contests, and winning was wonderful because it got me out of school for a day when we were sent off to a writing course. And then I produced a couple of plays based upon the novels Dracula and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and starred and directed them as well. And so I always wanted to do something creative, but my father was a lawyer, and I saw him do handle a murder trial where he defended on a pro bono basis somebody who was indigent, an older gentleman with a tracheotomy. And I was in junior high when I saw that. And that was better than Perry Mason or, you know, some TV lawyer show. And I thought, wow, that's really interesting. And I decided to become a lawyer.
Well, there's quite a difference in the process of writing and the way you even think as a lawyer, I would think. The good thing is there's a big structure to it. There's a structure to practicing law and a lot of studying and research, and that can cross over to writing a book, but there's also it's a different type of writing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think the discipline can translate over and be helpful, and as you mentioned, the research skill can be helpful, even though you're writing something that's fiction. In my case, I have to do a fair amount of research on various topics. So that ability to do research is helpful. But it turned out to be, although I thought I was a pretty good writer, it turned out to be far more difficult to write something that's fictional than the legal writing that I had engaged in for decades. And I can give you three examples. One is that when you write something for a client, for example, they want to know the summary or the conclusion right up front. So right at the top, you're going to tell them the conclusion that they need to go off and do or not do whatever they're looking to do. And in a novel, by contrast, you want to hide the ball or the conclusion all the way until the end. And then another example is that in a when you're engaging in legal writing, except for when you're being an advocate and writing a brief in a court case, for example, but if you're just conveying advice to a client, you want to convey it in a way that doesn't trigger their emotion. So it's just a nothing but the facts, ma'am, sort of dragnet style of writing. And the last thing you want to do is trigger the client emotionally, because you want them to act rationally. Whereas, as you know, in fiction, you want to be triggering the client, the reader all the way along. Otherwise, they're going to stop turning the pages. And then finally, the other thing you don't want to do with a client is trigger their imagination. You don't want them guessing at your advice or guessing at the fact pattern that you're outlining in the memo. But for readers of fiction, you want to be giving them just enough information to trigger their imagination to paint a picture of the world that as they see it, with enough information to also, you know, continue the story and set up the story for the next scene. And that was very challenging for me, because I felt like I needed to fill in all the white spaces when I was describing a room, for example, or location. And so that resulted in a lot of overwriting, which my editors, God bless them, helped me pare back quite a bit.
Well, how did you go about learning the craft of fiction writing?
Well, that's a good question. I gave myself a timeline for finishing a manuscript, and then I just sat down and started writing. And I read various books, including Stephen King on writing, and some of Hemingway's missives on writing. And there's another famous book, and I'm probably going to get the title wrong, but it's something to the effect of the skills of the selling writer, or something like that, which is a relatively old book, I think from the 1960s or 70s. And that was, those were quite helpful. And then there's loads of good stuff on YouTube, although you have to separate the wheat from the chaff. Mm. And so I just sat down and did it based upon, you know, my own studying, so to speak. And then a friend of mine who's a best-selling author introduced me to an editor. And I think that's really where the learning began. I thought that, you know, I was so happy when I finished the manuscript, and I felt like there was a huge amount of pain involved and struggle involved in getting the manuscript done. I had no idea that the real struggle started after I received comments from the editor.
Yeah, they're always a problem. I always end up finishing them off. You know, I end up, you know, they never work again after I, you know. No, actually, the editors in reality, if they really want to make a better book, and if you get one that you would connect with, it turns out really good.
Somebody told me, actually with another author, told me that, and I thought this was a great way to describe it, that the first draft is for the writer, and then the subsequent drafts, you know, based upon editors' comments, are for the readers. And I really liked that.
Yeah. I'd imagine now, because you've got, there's a lot of Japanese involved in this, and I see that, of course, you spent a lot of time in the Japanese culture, and you know the language and everything like that. So I'm guessing all the way through, you've probably put a lot of yourself into this whole, into the book and even the characters.
I think that's a fair statement. It's sort of inevitable, particularly with a first novel, to avoid, you can't avoid all of the autobiographical elements. At least if you're going to write about something you know, right? And one of the first rules I heard was write about what you know, and that's what I know. So I tried to pour that into it. But when it came to characters, I found that if I tried to base it on somebody I knew, it was too limiting, and it also it limited both what I could say about the character and also how they fit into the story. And so once I had that kernel, even if it was based on somebody or an interaction with somebody, once I had that kernel, then I made up everything else around it, so to speak.
Well, I see that you're a black belt in Aikido.
Yeah.
And, you know, being a martial artist myself, I was wondering, did you use your martial art experience to write your action scenes or anything like that?
It definitely helped. The caveat there is that was decades ago. I could probably barely fight my way out of a wet bag at this point. But I was pretty diligent at the time, you know, going 5 days a week and that kind of thing. And I have a friend who is still competes in judo in Japan, and I talked to him about it quite a bit. And I'm a fan of it. You know, I'm a fan of the movies, for example. So yes, I was definitely able to use some of that. And also there are some motorcycle scenes, and I love motorcycle riding. So I was able to use my experience riding motorcycles in Japan to write those scenes. And there was actually more about motorcycles in the book. And the first chapter I wrote was a motorcycle ride. That's not even in the book anymore. And that ended up on the cutting room floor. But one of my editors, I think in one of his first comments, was less motorcycle fetishness. So, and another friend of mine commented, you know, this reads like a motorcycle manual, don't you? So anyway, I had to cut quite a bit of that stuff.
Did you have a purpose or a point in your mind when you were writing the book? Like, was there a thought? And I guess the question would be, when you go to sit down and write this book, did you have a question or did you have a character that you were building this story on?
Yeah, that's a good question. I as I got older, I kept thinking, I had this idea of a story based on an international lawyer practicing in Tokyo. And I thought I could build something around that. And the older I got, the more I was really feeling compelled to write this. And then I hit a point where I thought, if I don't write it now, I'm never going to do it. So that's when I really focused on it in earnest. But I've had so much fun practicing law as an international lawyer in New York and in Tokyo. And don't get me wrong, there's a lot of drudgery in it, particularly at the junior level, and there's a lot of burnout. But at a certain point, I was able to really start enjoying the practice, and the cross-cultural aspects, the cross-border aspects, the cross-language aspects, I found very, very intriguing. And my son is biracial, his mother's Japanese. So, and I've seen him deal with that both in the U.S. and in Japan, where you're sort of betwixt and between. So he's sort of like a shapeshifter. He can be New Yorker one minute and then fly to Tokyo and be Japanese the next. But it's sort of like he's never quite one or the other. And I found that fascinating. And I just thought, if done right, it could be just a fun read for people. So I guess my goal was to create something that's a fun read for people.
That's it's an interesting idea. What is it, I guess at the end of the book, what is it you hope someone takes away from this story besides the entertainment, or was there something?
Well, so it's interesting you should ask that, because I didn't have like a moral, you know, sort of a sub theme involved in mind at the time. It was more sort of I had the books I was channeling or thinking about at the time when I wrote it were, there's obviously the James Bond series, there's Shibumi, which is a crazy book, and there's The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and Red Sparrow, and just something that involves international intrigue, that's sort of a legal thriller, although it's not a classic legal thriller in the sense that there's no court case, although there is corporate boardroom drama. And so I really, Al, I didn't think about it at the time, but when I got to the end, you know, your characters, you have, there's the climax and then, you know, sort of the wrap up. And I heard somebody say somewhere along the way while I was writing this, that your characters don't or shouldn't get what they want. They should get what they deserve. And that really resonated with me, because I thought, well, that makes it much more realistic, right? Obviously. After I finished writing it, somebody else asked me a similar question. And what I, when thinking about it, what I realized the answer is, even somebody who is personally has some real flaws and personal issues can achieve great things. And that's sort of, the sub theme, I think. But that doesn't mean you don't have to pay the piper, right? It's kind of like Moses not getting into the promised land because he doubted the word of God, right? So he was the only one who couldn't cross the River Jordan. It's sort of like that. Obviously not on that, you know, grand of scale, but it has that feeling to it.
Well, I know this is a big question, but you're talking to, about your son, and it made me think of it. What is maybe the biggest differences between living and practicing law in Japan versus the United States?
Well, I think for a non-Japanese person somebody who's half, in New York, anybody can be a New Yorker. If they're there long enough and if they work hard enough, you can fit in and become a New Yorker and feel like a New Yorker. But in Japan, if you're not Japanese, you're always sort of, you're categorized, you're in a certain category. In Japanese culture, that's always, they're excellent and amazing at categorizing people, categorizing everything. And you're always in that category. And there can be good things and bad things about it. But you're always, no matter how good your Japanese gets, no matter how culturally adept you become and how sophisticated you become, you're always looking from the outside in. Mm-hmm. Whereas in New York, I was born in Alaska and I grew up in Idaho, and so I'm not really a New Yorker, but after I'd lived in New York for several years, you know, I felt like a New Yorker. I was Wall Street lawyer, just like anybody who'd grown up in Manhattan. But in Japan, you're always a gaijin. You're always a foreigner. Now that's changed quite a bit, and there, it's got better, but Japan is, its history is not the same. And I'm not making a judgment here. It is what it is. The U.S. is the country that was built, through immigration, right? So we're all children of immigrants, almost all of us. Japan was not built that way, and in fact closed the country to protect itself from colonization around 1600 for almost 260 years. It was completely closed to the outside.
Yeah.
So there's been very little historically immigration there. And so the difference between Japanese, even the differences the distinctions Japanese make between Japanese and Koreans, Japanese and Chinese are quite clear. Now, that's true, I should say, in China and Korea as well. They, all the countries, it's sort of like Europe in that regard. People have very clear national identities, and those don't meld very much.
Well, what do you think that people get wrong about Japanese culture in general in America?
I don't know if they realize now the experiment that is going on, and so I guess there's two parts to this answer. One is that China, as you know, went through a cultural revolution, and China, if you look at it, there's a long history of that. So there's this history of, you know, 200, empire will last about 200 years and then it will collapse, and then a new one will rise, and the subsequent empires always sort of try to change or rewrite the history of the previous empires. And for example, the Mongolians really ran China at one point in time, and that's sort of a sore point for China. They don't like, they in fact tried to erase that part of their history. But the Japanese were never really colonized by anyone. And actually, the Mongolians tried, I think, in the 12th century. And that's where you get the story of the kamikaze destroying all of their ships and preventing them from conquering Japan. And so really, up until World War II, Japan had never been conquered. And then the Americans came in, but then they basically left. There's some bases there remaining, but they left the emperor in place, and they really didn't, you know, completely changed the culture. So the culture has really not changed for 1,000 years, which means it's quite rich and diverse. It used to be basically a bunch of little fiefdoms until it was united around 1600. And each of those areas, which are now separate prefectures like our states, have their own subcultures, which are very old, and their own food, and sometimes their own language, their dialects that people from Tokyo or other prefectures can't understand. So the language, the culture is quite deep and quite diverse, and really hasn't been changed that much by modernization. Although it is a very modern country that's very pleasant to work in, both live and work, particularly if you speak the language. But the other interesting thing about it is you have a declining and aging population, which a lot of countries do now. In the U.S., we're not experiencing this quite yet, although we seem to be getting close. And so there's this grand experiment going on there right now about, well, actually, how is that going to work out when we go from 125 million people now to, I forget exactly when, but let's say 2050, and we have 70 million people. What's going to happen to the economy? I can't tell you, and I don't know the answer to that, but I do know, you know, people are, the country's trying to grapple with that. But I can tell you that environmentally, great things are happening because you have less stress on the environment. So the water and air are becoming much cleaner. There's more open space. I fish a lot, so I see this firsthand. I fly fish a lot, and there are places in Japan now that you can fly fish in beautiful, clean water that it used to be devoid of fish, you know, 30 years ago because of pollution. So it's this grand experiment going on about how do you be sustainable and support the aged, for example. I don't think there's enough focus perhaps being put on what's going on in Japan right now.
Hmm. So now when we get to your book here, Bottle of Lightning, your main character, you know, Tom or Torne Segura, where did that character come from? How do you develop a character like that?
So, as you alluded earlier, to the it started out as an international lawyer sort of based on me. Which I didn't think that was particularly interesting in and of itself. So I thought of making him biracial would be interesting. And then I had to develop a whole backstory of where his family comes from. So I invented his mother as being this lawyer from Alaska who married a Japanese fisherman who had to leave the family because he was the third son and wouldn't take over the family business and went to Alaska to make his fortune, and so on and so forth. And because his mother was an American lawyer, he ended up becoming a lawyer. And so it involved a lot of time actually putting all these pieces together, because it is sort of made up out of whole cloth, so to speak.
Well, I'm wondering how you, I guess, experience your characters. Are you the type of writer that can hear the dialogue in your head, hear your characters, or is it mostly a visual experience to you?
It starts out visual. That's a very interesting question. It starts out visual. And it starts out sort of one-dimensional in the sense that I just have an idea for this character, and then I start playing around with that character. I write biographies for them, which I found quite helpful, because then you sleep on it, you know, your subconscious is working, and you end up with something that's more rich than you thought it was going to be. But I noticed that over time they stopped being stick people or stick men on a page and started taking on, they became alive, and they sort of had minds of their own. And so I was trying to pigeonhole them into doing certain things, and then I would realize, well, they're not really going to do that given their personality, and that made things more interesting but also more difficult at the same time. So it's kind of like you have a cutout, you know, placard of somebody sitting in your room that you're looking at, and all of a sudden that person, that placard takes on three dimensions and starts walking around the house and talking to you. Like, holy cow, you know, now I have to deal with it. It's kind of like when your child first starts talking back to you, and you're like, now I have to deal with a real human being, right? And that was, I sort of felt like Frankenstein, because now I've got, you know, people talking to me in my head.
Did they rebel against the plot?
They did, in the sense that the ending that I first had in mind didn't work. The ending doesn't work, but I don't know then how to end it. Right. And so they won't lead me to the ending. They're just telling me what's not. They're just saying I'm not going there. And then which is also like a little kid, right? And then you have to figure out, well, where should they be going? And that's when I knew, I started getting excited by that, but it also made it more difficult.
Yeah, it's frustrating.
Exactly.
So it sounds like you're hearing voices.
Yeah, exactly. And that was particularly at night.
Yeah.
I would wake up.
With a shovel and muddy shoes or something.
Yeah, exactly. So Torn was getting more and more, he was going to dark places. And he was a straight-laced, tech guy. He was basically a technology nerd. We had the science background, and also he graduated from law school, passed the bar, and is now a partner at a global law firm. And so he's pretty much, particularly in his professional life, his personal life is a separate issue, but in his professional life, he does things by the book. And he started, considering doing things that he never would have thought about just a few weeks earlier.
Yeah. And so do you act out these things? Do you to make sure that they're written correctly?
Well, that's a really good question. So the motorcycle scenes, I drove the expressways over and over again to get them right, which was good, but it also resulted in overwriting at first and too much just, you know, not letting the reader use their imagination at all. And so I had to cut that back. And then the scenes in the Russian Far East, I've been there several times, so I have a pretty good feel for the place. And that was a gold mine for ideas. And I've dealt with Russian lawyers, and that was also a gold mine. In fact, I was very good friends with the head of our Moscow office, which existed until several years ago. But so some of this stuff I actually did live.
I guess with today's climate and everything, the way you've got like some of the topics in the book, like climate change, and you're dealing with Russia and stuff like that. Are you at all concerned with being a little bit, I don't know, controversial a little bit, or being a little bit in an area that people will either like or dislike automatically because of the subject?
No, and I sort of crossed that Rubicon early on when I started reading about, I started writing this in 2017, and at the time I knew nothing about, because I was living in Japan practicing full time, and I knew nothing about quote unquote woke culture. This may get me in trouble. I started reading about it in the publishing industry and the issues that had shown up in the publishing industry. And so I started thinking, well, should I really be writing about this or that? And I figured that I just need to write what I want to write about and let the chips fall where they may, in part because you can't please everybody, right? And it's very subjective. I mean, legal writing, people can point out factual mistakes or that your analysis on when you apply the law to the facts is wrong, or, and you can discuss that. But in fiction, I think there's a lot more subjectivity. So that was one reason I decided not to worry about that so much. And then the other was I knew it was going to take quite a while, and things come in and out of fashion. So when I was writing this, I had no idea that what's going on with Russia and Ukraine was going to be going on. And I have friends in the Russian Far East, for example, and Russian friends who live in the US and in Europe. And so I knew nothing about that. And climate change, we have a very, in our firm, we have a very large energy group, and they do both conventional, which means gas and oil, conventional energy work, and renewable energy work, mostly wind and solar. And so when I was thinking about what technology to use to focus on, I thought energy would be a very interesting area. And I really didn't think about stepping on anybody's toes, or I just wanted to write something that, you know, seemed fun and cool and exciting.
So really, you're a Russian spy.
Yeah. It's funny you should say that, because I went to Russia, the Russian Far East, 6 times. And I was there fishing the whole time, each time. And it seemed like each time I went, my time standing in line at immigration in front of the immigration officer got longer and longer. And the last time I went, the woman behind the glass picked up the phone and was talking to on the phone for a while before they let me in. So I don't know what they were talking about, but I mean, the Russians are probably thinking, why is this guy showing up here in the middle of nowhere? Right. Yeah. This American. And I was with some other Americans and some Japanese people too. And you know, they're probably wondering, really, you came all this way to go fishing? Yeah, sure you did. And one of the places, Komsomolsk, it's called, is where the Russians, they build a lot of military hardware, including submarines there. And we were flying on our way to the river in this helicopter through Komsomol. So I can see where they might have been, you know, a little bit concerned about spying there. Have you ever been to Russia? It's a fascinating.
No. It was something that I wanted to do, you know, years ago, but I never did get a chance to. And now, well, you know, no, not now.
Well, and the thing about the Russian Far East is it's an area roughly the size of Alaska, Western Canada, and the U.S. Pacific Northwest down to California, roughly speaking. And Siberia is actually to the west of the Russian Far East, more in the middle. But there's only about 6 million people there. And so it really is the wilderness. It's one of the, almost the whole place is just devoid of any human activity. There are a few little towns there and a couple of, there's three cities, I would say, depending on how you describe, you define a city. So you end up flying and you end up staying in these places that are just so incredibly remote. It's kind of remarkable in this day and age that those kinds of places still exist.
Hmm. Well, you're lucky you made it out. No.
Yeah, very fortunate. Yeah. Very fortunate to make it in and out. Yes.
Yeah. Well, if I would have known the time and I knew you then, I would have called and warned them. I would have said, you know, he's an agent, just so you know. Just don't believe that fishing story, please. I could have come up with a better story. Well, so when you look back at this, so you finished it now, the book is complete and done. Is there anything that you would have changed looking back on it now? And the other thing would be, how has it changed you? Like, how did you change as a writer or a person going through this?
Would I do anything differently? Probably the only thing I might do differently is I indie published it. I set up my own publishing company and published it through that, which basically means forming a limited liability company and publishing. And I think if I had it to do all over again, and the reason I did that is I met people who were successful writers who were self-publishing, and they encouraged me to do it. I hadn't even considered that. And I was in the middle of querying agents when I met these people, and they were very encouraging and said, you know, do you really want to wait that long? And they had a point, because I started this in 2017 and it launches tomorrow on Amazon. And if I might still be looking for an agent, and even if I found an agent this year, it'd probably be another, 2 years, 18 months, 2 years before publication, right? So they had a good point there, but the only thing I might change is I wouldn't have queried as much, but I'm sort of hedging on that answer too, because the querying process was actually very educational as well. And I learned a lot from that, although it was sort of like, not sort of, it was very much analogous to looking for my first job, right? Yeah. You're just sending out query after query, and you have to get used to rejection, and you're so that was an interesting process. But I think the in answer to your second question, the way it's changed me is it's really addictive. So there's all this, it's you know, you're bipolar, right? It's you're manic depressive. It's these highs and lows, and you think, you know, screw this, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm going to go outside. Well, I don't want to be sitting here, and I don't know what I'm doing, and sucks, or I suck, or they, you know, it all, the whole thing sucks. And then, you know, you have a breakthrough the next day, and you're euphoric, and it's just this up and down part of it that can be wonderful and also, you know, very traumatic, at least to me. And so I thought, well, okay, I'm going to get this thing across the finish line, and then I don't know, you know, if I'm going to do it anymore. And now all I think about is writing. Well, I think about fishing too, but and so it's addictive, really addictive.
Oh yeah, and that emotional swing will continue for the rest of your life. Just don't think that's going away.
Yeah,
it's up and down like a toilet seat. It never changes.
I think one interesting thing that's also different from practicing law is when you're practicing law, you're used to your senior lawyers, opposing counsel, your clients all criticizing your written work product, both the substance and the writing, right? Just constantly. So the partners will, back in the day before everything was electronic, they would walk in with your memo all scrawled up with red pen, right? And they literally toss it onto your desk and say, fix this, and walk away, and you would have to sit there, deciphering the hieroglyphs that were their bad handwriting on the memo and revise it, right? So, but it was all work, and you were getting paid for it, and it was all very unceremonious. But I've noticed that in the creative world, people give feedback, but they're, most of them are careful about how they couch it, and they don't want you to slit your wrists or stop writing, right? And so you get this critique sandwich, which I found very funny at the beginning, because you get all the this is great, this is great, this is great, and then but, and the only important part of the critique is everything that comes after the but, right? until the other piece of bread on the back end where they say, keep it up, you're doing great. That's very different, also from legal writing.
Well, you should be glad you didn't have me as an editor. It wouldn't have been that nice. Are you kidding? Wow. That's, you had somebody nice, because I would have been like, are you kidding? What is this?
I did have some funny comments. I had one woman editor who said, why do you keep talking about women's breasts? And I was like, I don't know what to tell you. and I did a search, and the word breast only showed up three times in an 88,000 word manuscript, right? is that excessive? So you do have to stand up for yourself, but it's hard to know. At least it was challenging for me to stand up for myself. And then beta readers, of course, that was a whole nother thing.
Oh, they're terrible. Yeah.
Manage.
They're the worst, I'll tell you. Beta, well, they are. Beta readers think they know what they're doing, and they're just, get out of here. I'm not a beta fan. I just think it's terrible. But, they don't love me, so I don't love them. Actually, the editors, but the fight with the editor is kind of the good thing. So you can't hold back. You got to find an editor that you can kind of go back at.
Yeah.
Not angrily, but just kind of go, well, no, this is whatever. This is what you should have been able to say that to her three times in 88,000. Yeah. What are you talking about? Yeah. Then you kind of go back and forth. And if you find that person that you can do that with, you got it made. Because I found one over the years from one of the publishers I worked with, and I used her for everything, because we can do this back and forth, and nobody gets angry. It's just about, at the end of the day, it comes out better.
Yeah.
In my opinion, maybe not. Maybe that's.
I heard a story about Mel Brooks and Gene Wilder, and I think it was they were talking about Blazing Saddles. Anyway, one of the movies that they collaborated on, and Gene Wilder was writing part, if not all, of the screenplay, and Mel Brooks was reviewing it. And he commented on something and said, I don't know about this scene. Maybe it was Young Frankenstein, and it was the musical scene where the monster is dancing on stage and singing, putting on the Ritz. I think that may have been it, which of course is a brilliant scene. And Mel Brooks says, I don't know about this. And then Gene Wilder very passionately defended it. And said, well, for this and this reason, it's going to work. It's great. And Mel Brooks said, well, if you feel that way about it, then it's got to go in. And I thought that's an example of great collaboration.
Yeah, I think so. Because it's the passion, that means there's something there. And whether it's one-sided or the other, it's just, I think it's a great thing. And it's Frankenstein. Frankenstein.
Sorry. My apologies.
Yeah, we got to get that right. You know, because someone will be sending me an email saying, well, you didn't even get it right, man. Do you like social media? Or are you kind of in this modern world? And so you have a website set up and you have social media set up. And where can people find you?
Yes. I set it up. I was not in it until beginning of 2020. But everybody said I needed to be as an author, so I invented. I'm on Instagram as L Mark Weeks. I have a website, lmweeks.com. I'm on Facebook, both as LM Weeks and L Mark Weeks. So I have an author page on Facebook, and I'm even on TikTok. And I have a very small following on TikTok. I'm on Twitter. I don't know how you guys feel, but Twitter just seems like the silliest thing in the world to me, but I am on it. I stay away from all of the political discussion. It's really funny. Social media is so funny to me because you got Instagram, which I think is relatively, a lot of my photos and videos are fishing related. That's how I got a following until recently, you know, with the book launch. And Instagram, you get into a community and people post videos and photos and they're pretty supportive and nice. You rarely get a negative comment. And people are a little younger, but not as young as the TikTok crowd. And then the Facebook crowd is funny. It's like, you know, just a bunch of middle-aged curmudgeons trying to, you know, tell each other how much smarter than they are, whoever they're, you know, talking to online. And then Twitter is just seems total drivel to me, but that's just
modern. Well, that's sort of it's true. I mean, I think for the most part, most of them I just use for just posting. Okay, the show, who's on tonight, and who's coming up, and maybe a book post, and then I put really, really. As offensive a joke as I can each day to see how many more I can lose. Cause I, you know, there's like 6,300 or something on the one Facebook page. And I'm like, well, let's see if I can make someone upset. And you know what happens? I get 10 more. And then you always lose a couple, you know, but it's all in good fun. I just want people, you got to come on and laugh at this sort of stuff. I'm not big on that. That's why we don't even talk about it on air. We don't get into politics or.
Well, I think it was Michael Jordan was asked years ago about, well, what do you think about the Republicans or whatever it was, right? What do you think about their position on this? And he said, I don't know, but they buy my shoes. And I thought that was it's a brilliant response. And that's sort of my view.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Well, yes, it's the thing is I look at it both with radio and with the books and stuff. You know, people have you can find politics right now 24/7 on so many channels and networks and stations and shows. So let's just be one that is not, because I'm kind of tired of it now that I'm turning 60. I'm sort of over it. I'm checking out.
Well, let me just say about turning 60, you know, come on in, the water's warm. I just turned 60 last year, and it's much better than I thought it would be.
Well, yeah, I think it'll be fine. It's not like I have much of a choice, really.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You know, maybe I identify as a 40-year-old.
There you
go.
Maybe
I can pull that and see if I get away with it.
There you go. Why
I don't
not?
Think so. Yeah, well, yeah, I'll try, you know. Well, it's certainly been interesting. And, of course, we'll have everything up on our site. People can find you one click, and then they can, you know, come after you. And something you did wrong. There has to be something you said.
I'm sure.
But speaking of wrong, how was the last couple of years, but with the COVID and all that stuff, and I ask that not so much that, you know, about COVID, but with the way it was, did it sort of affect your writing?
If anything, it enforced more discipline. So I was really actually quite fortunate when COVID started. I was in Japan and I was scheduled to come down to the Keys for 3 months to fish during tarpon season from beginning of April. And a friend of mine in mid-March said, you better get here now because they're going to close it. So I got to the Keys and sure enough, 2 days later, they closed the overseas highway and no one could get into the Keys from the mainland. And so it was sort of like living in the largest gated community in the world. And all the boat ramps, the public boat ramps were closed, including in Miami. So nobody could get down to the Keys with their boat either. So I've never seen so few boats on the water. I mean, it was just wonderful. It was like it was, I'm sure, you know, 50, 60 years ago. So I was very fortunate. But then I had to go back to Japan. I also went to New York and Idaho as well. But every time I went to Japan, I had to quarantine for 14 days. And they were not draconian about it in the sense that as long as you weren't coming from Florida, where if you were coming directly from Florida and sometimes from New York, they made you quarantine in a hotel for 3 days. But most of the time you could stay in your own home and quarantine, and then they would call you daily on your phone and track your phone. But I'm stuck at home, right? So what else am I going to do? So I wrote. So that was actually, that sort of enforced some discipline. And is, at least for me, discipline is important.
Yeah. No, I see that. But the stress of it, the stress of what was going on, do you think that affects you, right? Because I've talked to a lot of writers, and some people say, you know, when it was going on, I was stressed and watching the news and everything's crazy and I couldn't write. And others were saying, oh, no, it was great. I just jumped right into it and had a great time.
Yeah, I was really stressed at the beginning, particularly before I flew to the Keys, because who knew what was going to happen, right? And that week before I flew, the numbers in the U.S. were skyrocketing. And they were skyrocketing in New York and skyrocketing in Miami. I didn't, you know what to expect to be. And, you know, we all were being told that, you know, we have to wash our plastic bags from the store, and wear plastic gloves and double your mask. And I was wearing an N95 mask with another mask over while I was on the plane. And that was all very stressful. And then I got to the Keys and I was outside every day. So I was blessed compared to most people in the world, I think. But then when I go back to Japan, you know, you're enclosed and you really can't go out. So, but I knew it was 14 days and I just looked at it as an opportunity to write. And to be honest, I stopped watching the news about COVID because I learned early on, there's nothing I can do about this. So I'm going to stop watching the news.
Yeah. It gets a bit redundant too all the time. It's all, you know, everyone's saying the same thing. So you kind of get tired of it. You know?
And there's that tracker with cases and deaths. And I thought, how is this helping me? Right. I know it's bad and I already know that. How are these numbers watching?
It's all fake. Forget it. It didn't happen. so just take that road and you're fine. Just go on out and about your day and nobody, it's just all good.
There you go.
See? Yeah. Well, great conversation. Well, everyone, you got to go out and buy this man's book. It's called Bottle Lightning. And, you know, he needs you to buy his book because he's did this without an agent. Okay. So he needs the help. Well, we appreciate being on the show, Mr. Al M. Weeks. Thank you.
Al, David, thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to appear on your show.
Thank you.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino Movie Reviews.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.